Bombshell. I'm Radha Iyengar.
I'm Lauren DeYoung Shellman.
And I'm Erin Simpson. What are we drinking this week, ladies?
We are drinking an Aperol Spritz, which is a fancy Italian aperitivo with Aperol, soda water, and Prosecco. However,
that is not what Erin is drinking.
Confess that Erin is not drinking that. Erin brought a flask because apparently it's been that kind of week.
You know, it's only Monday, but last week was definitely an intense week in the national security world, and I feel like felt like a flask of Templeton Rye was just really what the situation called for. So
I just feel like the sun is out, and I know that the world has gone to shit, but I'm going to drink my orange aperitivo as though I haven't a care in the world, even though I do.
Hear, hear.
Sounds right.
That's, I have no, there should be
hard
no
to argue.
No objections. We are also in roof deck season here in the great Washington, D.C.
Oh, yeah, we should work on that for a recording.
Yes, we should find, we've brainstormed some ideas about recording in other locations, distilleries, breweries, and the greater roof decks now of Washington. So we should, sponsors, if anybody wants to, pay our bar tab while we record in your famous establishment, they should get in touch.
Definitely.
For sure. Okay, so we obviously have a lot to talk about this week.
I'm tired already.
So there are so many foreign relations to keep us to keep up with that we are not going to keep up with them all. We're going to do a quick run through later. But first, we want to talk about something that is still a thing, as we say. The great unmasking, or the scandal of Congressman Nunes, or the guy who snuck into the White House thinking that nobody was actually going to see
him. Or the
him.
Worst spy novel ever written.
This is so terrible that I just, like, I couldn't pitch it to, like, Slate and they would buy it. But, so, where are we with the great unmasking?
This was a huge story, like less than a week ago.
Right.
Right.
A week ago. I'm still getting, like, media requests of, like, please come talk about the great unmasking. And, like, this is, it's absolutely crazy. So, to kind of talk about this in reverse, we are now at a point where the alt-right, the right wing of Congress is, both of them are just obsessed with the fact that apparently Susan Rice, Ambassador Susan Rice, former National Security Advisor and my former boss, is in their mind the evil demon of the great unmasking, which is absolutely...
And was originally the evil demon in Benghazi, which
right.
of course from which this all stems.
And then, like, if you were paying attention, was the evil demon of the Bo Bergdahl scandal. Let me point out for the record that Susan Rice is not an evil demon. She's actually quite a nice and very smart lady, but she's a very convenient bad guy anytime something happens in Washington. And I'm sure every person who saw this come up was totally thrilled that it would be Susan who would be popping up on all their screens come to fore. So how is Susan involved? Apparently, Ambassador Rice requested, on receiving a piece of intelligence, requested to know who the U.S. person who was listed in this piece of intelligence was.
Let's back up a little bit. So when you have a piece of intelligence that mm-hmm. mentions U.S. people, they're not listed by name, right?
No, they're listed as U.S. person one or
their
U.S.
identities
person two.
Are masked.
Their identities are masked. You may not be the person who's talking in it. You may be just being talked about, maybe being right. mentioned by somebody, but your name is in there and has been masked in some way by the intelligence community. They do that on purpose. So sometimes when you're reading these things, it makes a big effing difference who that person is. It may be not a big deal, and I can just let this go. It may be, oh my gosh, this is treason.
It also often adds to the credibility of actually reading the report. Like, is the person they're talking about someone who could credibly provide the information they're saying?
Right.
If not, maybe these people are just making up a bunch of stuff and we don't care about this intelligence.
So as is a normal process, quote, normal, very normal, not often, but normal, Ambassador Rice apparently requested to find out the name of people that were listed in the Trump transition or Trump campaign on at least one intelligence report. This is all kind of like 79th hand since we're seeing it in alt-right media these days. And the intelligence community reviews those requests and decides whether or not to offer it, to give more information or not, gives them back. And
just to emphasize that point that Lauren's making, it is the nonpartisan, fact-based intelligence community that takes the request from whoever makes it on unmasking, reviews the reasons for that request and the underlying intelligence to decide whether unmasking is necessary for some reason as specified in the request. So it's not like Susan Rice waves a magic wand and the name appears.
And generally speaking, they would not find political retaliation to be a sufficient cause for reviewing those names.
Usually, right. In order to understand the context or the report and whether or not this is a really big deal for national security, which, seemingly by giving this to the National Security Advisor, it is already a pretty big deal for national security. That would be the basis for them deciding it's okay to unmask or not. And they can say no, and they do say no. So apparently what we are demonizing Ambassador Susan Rice for is more or less doing her job, which is not uncommon amongst women in national security.
Not at all.
But also to emphasize the point that it's not just doing her job, but that the National Security Advisor to the current President of the United States was presented intelligence that suggested that American personnel were colluding with Russian officials based on surveillance or whatever collection was happening of those Russian officials, colluding with them to impact the U.S. electoral process. That is the intelligence she was given.
And that's a big deal, no matter what the names are revealed.
Or no matter who actually requested it. All of these, the substance of the issue is a big deal,
so
whether
that
was Mike Flynn or Susan Rice.
If the situation were that she didn't request the names to understand it, we would have some serious questions as to why,
for sure,
when presented with that information, she would not want to know what U.S. persons were involved in colluding with Russian officials, right? I mean, this is kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation.
So to close out my summary of this is still a thing, I know many of us have a chip in our brain that goes off when you see Susan Rice on the screen of this is a terrible thing, this must be bad. I want you to think back for a moment of why she's on the screen. It's because we're looking into whether or not the President of the United States or his campaign or his transition team was colluding with Russia. That seems to me like a big effing deal, to quote one Vice President Joe Biden.
And we don't have the answer to that question yet, right? This is actually why people want either a select committee or an independent commission or some other investigative body.
I haven't gotten my tattoo yet, but I will.
And it's also why Devin Nunes had to step aside,
correct,
not as chairman, but as lead of this investigation, because, right, which I tend to think he should have done since he was a member of the Trump transition team, which is under investigation. But regardless, having traipsed around the White House grounds at night and read this information off somebody's JWix terminal, he's now no longer able to independently investigate whatever might have happened. I think it's important to remain relatively open-minded about the various potential.
That's right.
Outcomes
and
here.
And the degree of witting and unwitting.
That's why you had to investigate it.
Right.
Independently, maybe not politically, maybe not just watching Fox News.
Okay. We're going to try to keep up foreign relations, but we're going to do a bad job of it because there were
too many.
So many relations to be kept up.
So many relations this last week. Radha, what were you watching?
Well, I was most recently watching about these terrible attacks in Egypt and then the subsequent declaring of a state of emergency, which I'm not totally clear on what that means when you can already arrest dissidents without trying them, etc. But certainly it was
these were ISIS attacks against
tragic
a Coptic
day
church.
On Palm Sunday. Yeah,
for sure.
OK, so there was the cheese summit with President Trump down at Mar-a-Lago.
That's right.
Apparently kind
we
of
had a help. We had a Chinese major state visit.
It was crazy. We had a major state visit, but apparently we launched T-Lambs in the middle of that, so it became something of a nothing burger. Or at least, I guess it wasn't a total failure, which I guess it could have been worse. So we saw that, but I have nothing further to say, and I don't think that China or the United States really does either.
And now we have a carrier battle group steaming in the general direction. It's not really steam. Nuking? You don't say that. But they're moving.
Rolling.
They're also
rolling.
Not sailing. I mean,
they're
I don't know what the verb is to
moving?
Use here.
They're moving. Moving in the general direction.
Of the Korean Peninsula. That has been described
as
merely prudent. And we'll see, what that looks like, both from a deterrence perspective for the North Koreans. There's an anniversary coming up here that's meaningful, that often results in a lot of tests, but also reassurance to allies both in Japan and South Korea. So,
but what everybody in the foreign policy community was watching this week was Syria. So instead of spending a lot of time on these other issues, we're going to do a deep dive on Syria, the chemical weapons attack, the subsequent U.S. response, and the long-term implications with a special guest. So we are incredibly excited this week to have a special guest with us, Melissa Dalton, who is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I have known Melissa for longer than I will admit as a veteran, fellow veteran of OSD policy, where she was a special assistant to Michelle Flournoy. She worked in the Middle East office. She did a million other saving the world kind of things. And we have her here today to talk about what everyone is talking about in Washington, Syria. Difference being, Melissa will actually bring some experience and expertise to it, whereas I think everyone else has been practicing their hot takes, myself included, for the last several days. But first, before we get into that, we want to go through our typical guest questions for Bombshell. Our first one being the best meal you have ever eaten while traveling, Melissa.
Well, thanks so much for having me on today. It's a true pleasure. The best meal I've ever had while traveling is definitely a Thai, but the two experiences have a common strain in common. One was eating mezza in Damascus, actually, in 2006.
Way to stay on brand. We like it.
Yes, you know, just, but it's true. Just like a table full of delicious mezza shared with friends with some oud music playing in the background. Truly an amazing night. But that has a tie distinctly with eating at a Argentinian steakhouse in Buenos Aires with the provoletta and the Malbec and the whole deal. And in both experiences, the entire surface area of the table was covered. So I think that's the, common stream there.
I'm hungry now as you talk. Okay, so what is the book you have either reread the most or you have owned the longest?
So probably a lot of commonalities with other women out there. Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, tried and true in terms of its character development, in terms of the degree of self-awareness that the characters achieve over time. I return to it year after year.
And here's where we get embarrassing. What is the fan club or fan community that you have been a part of at some point in your life?
So this is kind of obscure, but when I was in college, I was a part of a volunteer search and rescue group. We looked for lost people in the wilderness. And
where did you go to college?
University of Virginia in Charlottesville,
okay.
Virginia, so close to the Blue Ridge Mountains. But we responded to searches in the Mid-Atlantic, and there's definitely a subculture for search and rescue. And I think that very early on also indicated a proclivity for paramilitary organizations, which led to other interests. Down the road at DOD.
That is amazing. I feel like we need a separate segment devoted purely to that, but I will move on to your Twitter or Facebook crush, somebody that you follow but you don't necessarily actually know in real life.
So I love following the work of the analysts up at the Century Foundation, who do very solid work on Syria. Aaron Lund, Sam Heller, Michael Wahid Hanna, and Thanasis Kambenis. They do...
Sam Heller and I were talking about Crimetown.
Yeah.
Recently, yeah.
They do great work on Syria and have kind of a contrarian point of view that I feel like is an appreciated dose of cold water when it's hard to be optimistic on Syria, certainly. But from a policy perspective, you know, you're always trying to find some pathway forward. And I feel like their analysis routinely keeps me grounded. So, yes.
Awesome. We'll have to follow those guys. Next question. What is your favorite museum?
Far and away, the Churchill War Museum in London is just phenomenal.
Jim Townsend did not bribe you to say that.
He did not. He did not.
Is that the war cabinet rooms or is it the separate one?
Yeah. Yes, it's the war cabinet rooms and getting to walk through the subterranean spaces. They've largely kept them intact, so you really get a feel for what it was like during the war and just some really great artifacts and literature to pick up while you're there.
So given that you were part of the search and rescue subculture, you'll have a good basis for this next question, which is, what is your favorite geek field trip?
So again, some similar strains here, but I would have to say staff rides are among my favorite geek field trips.
Absolutely.
Have had an opportunity to do a number of the last years, and at CSIS on my team, we've instituted it as an annual team building exercise. So we are due to go out to Bull Run in May. So excited for that.
Awesome. Okay, last question. I don't know why I'm asking this question, but I will because I have no answer to it. What is your favorite statistical distribution?
So, and I oddly am going to attempt to answer this as I have not used statistics and econometrics in my work since I was a grad student. But I think the beauty of the normal distribution is...
Finally, somebody does the obvious answer.
Right. A normal distribution.
Waiting this whole time for a normal distribution person.
So I could have said normal distribution because I knew what it was, but I decided not to like fake it and pretend as though like I had really deep thoughts about it.
It has its limits, but the ability. But
that was so good, Aaron. That was so good.
You're the only one who knew that was a joke.
But you know, if you get the right amount of sample size, it's a pretty useful tool to look at a set of random.
Next
variables.
Week on Bombshell, the law of large numbers and the central limit theorem.
I know. I was just going to say everything tends normal. Everything tends normal.
We're very excited to have such interesting and compelling guests in our violence done to the field of statistics every week here on the show.
So moving on from one topic Lauren knows nothing about to another one that I can only give hot takes about, Syria. So we'll go through, ask Melissa to go through, like, what is it that has happened in the last few days? I will say that's what happened in the D.C. community has been a lot of really interesting both catharsis and angst and disagreement over what is actually going on, what are the interpretations of what's going on. Even amongst the Trump administration, just their own mixed messaging on what exactly their strike in Syria meant last Thursday has been just a sight to behold. And I feel like that everyone kind of hates each other and loves each other at all at once one time in terms of Syria policy. So I will turn it over to my slightly more experienced colleagues to kick off.
So Melissa, why don't you start, walk us through what happened recently and why we should care?
So last week, we witnessed yet another chemical attack by the Assad regime against Syrian civilians. And, you know, this was certainly not the first time that Assad had deployed this terrible weapon to instill fear and a sense of deterrence within Syria itself. Notably in 2013, a very horrific attack in East Ghouta, which resulted in an international response to remove the chemical weapons. But of course, in the run-up to that, the famous Obama red line being laid down, and a lot of critique of the Obama administration following that. But even after the supposed removal of Assad's chemical weapons, it turns out that he still had a bit of a stockpile and has tended to use it from time to time strategically at moments in the conflict since then. But this most recent incident last week did kill about 80 civilians and, you know, lit aflame the international press response, put a lot of pressure on the new U.S. administration to, I think, in some ways differentiate itself from the Obama administration. Of course, the situation on the ground is quite different now than it was in 2013. You have Russia having intervened. You have a much more robust Iranian IRGC-backed presence. And the country is just far more fragmented, plus the actual presence of U.S. Military personnel supporting non-state actors in northern Syria as well as next door in Iraq. So the situation on the ground being quite different, but I think a lot of pressure on the administration to provide a response. And subsequently, within the span of 48 hours, national security policy apparatus turned around a military option to conduct a limited missile strike using Tomahawk missiles from destroyers in the eastern Mediterranean against the air base from which the chemical attacks had been launched. It was very much a symbolic strike. I think helpful.
What do we mean by that? When we say it's a symbolic strike, there's been obviously a lot of, I don't know, Twitterati complaining that the airstrikes didn't destroy the runway. And then the president himself chimed in to usefully or helpfully let us all know that you don't strike runways because they're easy to repair. What in your mind, what's sort of the value of a symbolic strike or the strategic impact of us as a put? And what would it have looked like for it to have been a more attritive strike?
Right. So had it. The intent been to actually ground the Syrian Air Force, prevent it from conducting future airstrikes, I think it would have looked a lot different, a lot more saturated, perhaps not just limited to that location, probably a different time of day to ensure that more aircraft, more substantial damage to the actual runways and capabilities of the Air Force could have been degraded. But instead, it was, I think, intended to minimize potential escalation with the Russians. There had been a Russian military presence in the area, some advisors reportedly still present, but the United States did give the Russians advance warning. It was done at night to minimize casualties. And was intended to be just a limited symbolic strike.
Right. And I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but certainly the sort of Mattis statements post have been really focused on a signal related to the use of chemical weapons.
That's
specifically.
Right.
But so, they also, the strikes also weren't designed to reduce or destroy the chemical weapon stockpiles that we think may have been located on this base, because that would have had other effects.
That's
you can't
right.
just blow up a bunch of sarin nerve agent.
Right, correct. Right. I mean, it would have had very dangerous consequences for civilians in the area. So, yep.
So I think the goal was to destroy some stuff and just say, if you do this, we're going to smack you.
It's a classic punitive strike, but it's right. It's interesting to watch that then play out in the commentariat as to
right.
Whether that we intended for it to be limited, what the intended message was. And part of the reason it's been difficult to figure out what the intended message was is that the administration has been, if not all over the place, at least in many places, on the Sunday shows and over the weekend with regard to what our Syria policy actually is. So
right.
we have Tillerson and some others sort of focusing on this was about chemical weapons, and, you know, Assad, we're kind of ambivalent on whether Assad, you know, stays or goes. Nikki Haley, who had the same comments last week, but this week, you know, is very insistent that there's no future political solution with Assad still in power.
Right. And, and pretty impassioned speeches and showing pictures on the floor and so forth.
Exactly.
Right?
And on the Sunday shows as well.
Yeah.
You know, I watched General McMaster, you know, try to tap dance his way through reconciling those statements. That's an interesting image, I suppose. But, you know, that's, I can't figure out what our Syria policy is. I still have no idea whether regime change is on the table or whether, no, it's limited strike to change some battlefield conditions and we want to move on from there.
So, but to me, the question is actually not just what our Syria policy is, but what could it possibly reasonably be at this point? Like,
right.
what is a realistic
right.
near-term, medium-term set of policy options for this administration, given where we are with the Russians, with the Syrians, based on this strike? I admit, like, over the weekend, I was just sort of befuddled the entire time thinking, what happens next? I honestly have no idea. So I'm very curious to hear your take on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think those are all the right questions that we should be asking and are hopefully being thought about. You know, it's natural at this point in administration to be doing a policy review of, you know, current operations and the policies surrounding them. You know, there was already a military commitment to counter ISIS that has been ongoing, passed on from the previous administration that the Trump administration has to account for. Still clearly counter terrorism reasons why we need to be there in force, and of course also the growth of the al-Qaeda affiliated groups in northern Syria, continually succeeding in saturating some of the Syrian opposition groups that we would hope to be partnering with us to counter ISIS and possibly more broadly form the basis for some sort of new Syrian future. But more broadly, you know, there it seems that the new administration is kind of adopting a similar strain to the previous administration, where on one hand, you know, it's all about counter ISIS, counterterrorism, but also Assad must go, but not a clear strategy that links the two.
Right. And I think part of the problem that this administration has, which is the same problem the previous administration has, is, you know, there's a bunch of trade-offs in anything that's not related to ISIS. Actually, it also relates to ISIS, which I can come back to, but that nobody really wants to talk about, which is, what do we want our Middle East regional strategy? And we need to think here about sort of countering Iranian influence, but also what our strategy is in the civil wars that take place related to sort of Shia affiliated and Sunni affiliated groups, and how much we care about that balance of power, how much we care about Russian influence in the region, and what do we want to do versus countering the Russians? Are we friends with the Russians now?
And Russian
now maybe
influence
we can,
in other regions.
Correct. And and how that relates to Russian influence in other regions. What we ourselves think about some of the humanitarian issues, and we've talked about the refugees in terms of travel bans and a little bit of instability in Europe, but there's a huge host of humanitarian issues, some of which got raised in the discussion of the chemical weapons attacks, but some of which are very destabilizing to the region, just generally separate and above our concern for these people as actual human beings.
Yeah.
And then there's the terrorist groups of which, of course, ISIS is our sort of most prominent, but hardly the only group there. And certainly it's competing in a pretty competitive and dominant ungoverned space that spans across Syria and northern Iraq. And
or competitively governed space, for sure.
Right. Exactly. And sort of how do we want to balance targeted military operations on those groups who we partner with to fight those groups, and balance of power vis-a-vis all of these different actors
you
in the region.
Have
and
all
we don't
the questions, Radha. Every time with these questions.
But I think that the issue that the last administration struggled with, and what this administration could really do, in my view, in a policy review, is actually just lay out what are our priorities, because we can't have it all in a pony. And so, kind of the. I mean, I would love a pony.
We all want a pony.
For listeners, you know, just for future reference. But, and so I'd be really interested in your thoughts, Melissa, and generally all of our thoughts on where should those priorities shake out, and how should we even begin thinking about breaking this down?
I think to break it down, the three core interests or objectives the United States has in this conflict, and it really is a conflict that has geopolitical consequences, you're absolutely right to ask those questions, are the counterterrorism interest, the interest in preventing military escalation with Syria and Iran, or sorry, with Iran and Russia, but at the same time pushing back against their subversive influence in the region, and then also trying to push back and contain the destabilizing effects of this conflict on neighboring states as well as into Europe. And that relates to not only the refugee flow and migration, but also the kind of hidden elements of the spread of terrorism, the spread of arms, and violent extremism.
You've mentioned Iran now a couple of times. I know your team at CSIS has just completed a big report on Iranian activity and influence in the region. Can you kind of, you know, the Russian influence, I think, in the Russian considerations have dominated most of the public discussion of Syria and constraints and Syria policy options. We know that as we mentioned, you know, that the airstrikes were designed not to fall on any Russian personnel or equipment, for example. Without going into the like many decades long history of Iranian influence in Syria, although we can sort of stipulate that, you know, what is the, you know, Iranian regime and the Revolutionary Guard up to in Syria, and how does that play out in terms of, I guess, most importantly, Iraq is probably the other place that's
absolutely
has biggest influence. But this is, you know, you spent a lot of time on that. I want to make sure we give you a chance to say a little more.
Oh, I appreciate it. We just released a report a couple of weeks ago, Deterring Iran After the Nuclear Deal, that looks at this issue at Syria, but in the context of broader Iranian activities in the region. And Iran, obviously, you know, Syria is an existential challenge for Iran. Syria is
How so?
The means by which Iran is able to resupply Lebanese Hezbollah, which is a strategic deterrent vis-a-vis Israel. There are also key command and control nodes that Iran leverages in Syria to be able to influence and direct Lebanese Hezbollah operations. And so the Iranian intervention into Syria is core to the Islamic Republic's core interests in the region as they relate to Israel and its power projection. And so as we saw Assad's military start to flag, starting in about 2013 and into 2015, until the Russians really intervened, Iran, of course, mobilized Lebanese Hezbollah to move into Syria. Big strategic calculation there in terms of moving it off of the northern border with Israel that, you know, tells you how serious they were taking the situation. And then, of course, also deploying additional IRGC, Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps-backed advisors into Syria to recruit local Syrians, to buttress Lebanese Hezbollah, but also to bring in a number of foreign fighters, Afghans, Pakistanis, other Shia from the region.
And that's all in support of the Assad regime.
All in support of the Assad regime. Again, because, you know, we saw the Assad military starting to flag in terms of its force numbers, in terms of its ability to hold territory. And so essentially you have a nice little IRGC ring around Damascus, and, you know, buttressed by Lebanese Hezbollah. And so there are big questions in terms of the long-term influence and presence of these groups that I'm sure are worrying our Israeli partners and should worry us. And I would argue that needs to be on the table for the end state in Syria as a red line, perhaps not stated as such publicly, but as a part of the negotiation process to ensure that those IRGC-backed groups do not have a long-term presence in Syria.
But on that line, I mean, I think the flip side of this is it's clear that in some ways this is an existential issue for Iran.
Yep.
It's certainly a substantial, if not existential, issue for Russia, right? The bases there are relevant. They're present. There's a reason why Putin is backing Assad.
This is a question. I was home over the weekend and both sets of my parents asked me, why do the Russians care about Syria? You know, and I actually had to sit for a minute and sort of think, well, it's Tartus. I mean, it's a, you know, warm water port.
Yeah. Big bases and warm water ports.
That's a 200-year-old problem, yeah, if not longer, you know, for Russian, you know, military and diplomatic strategy.
But
right?
And it's influence in the region, right? And yeah, that's a region.
Right.
This is their toehold and their partner, mm-hmm, in the region. And for us, it's never going to have that kind of salience. And so while it's relevant for us, the U.S., I'm saying here, but really in some ways European allies too, to get some kind of stable solution, I think it's not... We're never going to get a solution that gets all the way to what we want, given how important this is for Russia and Iran. And I think that has stymied a lot,
yep,
of progress. And I had joked that everything I have to say about this, I said in this paper I wrote in 2013. But I think that's right, which is, you know, I can imagine end states that involve things like partition or an Assad-like regime retaining some political control and some negotiated political settlements. It's hard for me to imagine a realistic solution that doesn't involve that, given what's at stake for Iran and Russia, but maybe there's more optimism than I...
More happiness to be had. Unlikely, sadly.
That's a good transition to end states in general,
yes,
which I know we want to talk about.
Yes. No, I mean, I think, Radha, you're rightly pointing out, you know, this gets to a point, a question of leverage, which I think has eluded the United States in Syria, because as you said, you know, it's not as existential for us. We, historically, the United States has not had strong strategic interests in Syria. It's how Syria has connected to the broader region vis-a-vis Israel, vis-a-vis Lebanon and Lebanese Hezbollah, its connection to Iran, that it has mattered.
During the war in Iraq, there was certainly a pipeline of foreign fighters.
From a CT perspective, and we actually toyed with some cooperation with Assad regime, you know, when I was at DOD. And so, you know, there haven't been strong, compelling reasons why we have cared about Syria itself. It's the impact that the Syrian conflict has had on the region. And so when it comes to thinking about end states and how we bring this thing to some sort of political settlement at the end of the day, we don't have as much skin in the game or as much leverage as the Russians and the Iranians do. And so it is going to require some degree of compromise, but in advance of that, trying to increase our hand, increase our leverage in the situation. And that is when we have to look more holistically at the region and globally to understand how much this matters to us in terms of global trade-offs. Whether that comes on the diplomatic side, on the economic side, vis-a-vis Ukraine, vis-a-vis Iranian activities in the region, how much are we willing to live with and how much does Syria matter?
It's a good question, though. We think about the relationship between leverage and skin in the game, right? We have been, you know, for the most part heretofore, not particularly willing to put skin in the game. That said, we've seen a pretty significant uptick in troops on the ground, right? Mm-hmm. Both special operations, but also conventional forces for the first time in the mm-hmm. last month. Some of that was being planned by the Obama administration and then was to be executed by the new Trump administration. But we have, you know, Marines in northern Syria. We have Rangers in northern Syria. We have folks in Iraq as well. And that, to me, sort of... I mean, as somebody who had not been particularly supportive of increased engagement in Syria, right, much to the chagrin of a great number of my, you know, friends and colleagues, you see how this escalation pipeline starts to work, though.
Yes.
Right. There's troops on the ground. I, of course, when we hear about airstrikes, my first thought is actually, what are the implications for those troops? Even though they're not geographically nearby, they... you know, you've got to assume that there's some ISIS commander or potentially even a regime, you know, in a rogue regime element. I mean, how many guys do you put after trying to kidnap a Marine or a Ranger? I mean, that's a significant strategic advantage, right, if you can sort of pull a Hezbollah 2006
right
style operation, you know. And so this is what much of the Obama administration, though certainly not all of the Obama staffers in the Obama administration, resisted.
Yep.
And now we've sort of crossed that first, you know, bridge of increased engagement. And, you know, whether we think about end states in terms of the political situation in Syria and both the political solution, but also resolving some form of the humanitarian suffering, which is just unimaginable. I mean, literally unimaginable, I think. I still don't really know what the U.S. role is, how we get there from here in a way that doesn't lead to 30 or 50 or 100,000 troops at some point.
I think that's right. So I struggle with this issue of what intervention looks like for that same reason, that I think we have not in the past in the U.S. shown ourselves to be particularly great at bounded mission sets in intervening in countries. See, this is still a thing, Afghanistan from a couple episodes right ago. So, you know, I'm hardly an advocate for throwing a bunch of troops on the ground and saying we're going to stabilize this country. On the other hand, I think figuring out what our strategy is with a quasi-hostile, but like, let's be honest, right? We don't really like Assad. We didn't hate him that much before.
Mm-hmm.
He's not great, but, you know,
we certainly hate him more now. I mean, it's very difficult to engage with him.
He's done lots of bad stuff, but like, just to be clear, there are lots of leaders of lots of countries in the world who do lots of really bad things who we hold our nose and figure out how to deal with because it's in our strategic interest too. And I think figuring out what this administration thinks and does with those leaders is going to tell us a lot sort of in the coming weeks on not just Syria, but how we think about other places like Egypt and Libya and so on and so forth, and kind of dealing with those sort of future strategies, as well as, you know, hopefully establishing a national security policy review process, maybe.
Well, on that cheery note, you know, Radha, I think that's, we'll thank Melissa for joining us today.
Thank you.
Has been a great primer for Syria policy and some looks forward, and hopefully we'll have you back here sometime soon.
Look forward to it. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. Moving on to what is, I think, still our favorite segment, White House Mayhem. It never disappoints.
It is the gift that keeps on giving.
What do we...
But there's good news this week, guys. There's good news this week.
There is.
It seems as though General McMaster has been starting to get an NSC staff. It is his and not Mike Flynn's, and they seem to be some pretty good folks. What do we know?
All kinds of folks. I guess the most recent development has been that KT McFarland is going to become the ambassador to Singapore, which actually sounds like pretty good duty. And
I would absolutely take that.
If you like malls and air conditioning, that's going to be a great, great assignment. So she will no longer be the deputy national security advisor.
And I guess Bannon is no longer officially on the National Security Council.
Yeah, so there was a ton of like Sturm und Drang around this when it first happened. We talked about it in one of our very first episodes. Lauren, does this actually matter? Is this symbolic? Is it matter procedurally? Can he still show up to these meetings?
He can totally still show up to these meetings, basically whether he's invited or not. He can still, as evidenced by the press release, give the president national security advice. He was in the room when they were talking about Syria. So he is still in the White House. So if people worry about Steve Bannon having influence in the president's foreign policy, keep worrying, but maybe give a small point of victory to McMaster to get him off the official list.
And I believe the Joint Chiefs are back on the regular list.
Joint Chiefs,
the Department of
the
Energy,
the intelligence community, the Department of Energy, the CIA, all of these folks are back on a list that, as I talked about in the first time, doesn't really matter all that much. But it's nice. It's nice to have. It's nice to have a backup invite list if you lose your, you know, your normal person.
So we're back to sort of normalcy, at least in terms of the standard, you know, invites that go out. Fiona Hill has joined from Brookings at the Russia desk. And that
I
seems
think it's
to be
Russia, combined Russia and Europe, right? Yeah.
Yes.
Nadia Shadlow is running the strategic planning process, the national security strategy process. Dina Powell will possibly be the deputy national security advisor, though it's unclear how they're going to work that out. And a few others have apparently been added on staff as they've moved through their restructuring of the NSC, which is all good news in terms of wanting a, you know, regular order, pretty boring, normal National Security Council process.
Of course, we didn't really see that process at work in the 60-some hours it took to move from Syrian chemical weapons attack to Tomahawk launch.
No, they apparently had a deputies committee meeting, a very brief principals, a very brief NSC meeting. And I have to say, when you look at a timeline that says, like, we had a deputies at night and a principals in the morning and an NSC at noon, that means the NSC is not working. because nobody can actually get work done in between any of those meetings. That's just people getting together to talk to make themselves feel good.
And that was happening in the midst of the Xi summit.
In the midst of the Xi summit. So people on Air Force One, which is kind of amazing, they can have a principal's meeting or an NSC meeting on Air Force One. But at the same time, what was interesting to watch is they were preparing for this Syria counterattack as well as the Xi summit. You saw somebody who was not on the National Security Council having a great deal of influence.
The greatest intern of all time.
Jared Kushner, who I admit I spent 5 minutes
secretary
today
of everything.
Coming up with an Alexander Hamilton cover about Jared Kushner, and I won't do it because I like you guys.
It's because we didn't have enough Aperol spritzers,
apparently,
I think,
not.
Guys.
I think we could get her to do it if we had more Aperol. That's right.
Jared Kushner, he has been to Iraq. He ran the Xi summit preparation. He is in charge of Veterans Affairs, the opioid crisis, Middle East peace.
Bringing business innovation to the government.
Right. He's doing all these things without any real title except for like the head of White House innovation. And what's noticeable to me, like he was part of all these major national security processes. He's not on the NSC. So maybe Bannon not being on that list, not such a big deal. Who knows? But more importantly about Jared Kushner, there's so much to talk about Jared Kushner's visit to Iraq.
I mean, mostly we want to talk about is what he was wearing, right? I mean,
guys, picking out your combat gear is hard when you're a civilian going on your combat.
Oh, it's totally hard. But this is why I think we come back full circle to our last week when this is why civil servants matter.
Really matter, guys.
Because you could have asked any number of civil servants who have been to Iraq or Afghanistan or any war zone and said, what should I wear?
And they definitely would not have said navy blazer and khakis.
Definitely not, no.
Well, they certainly wouldn't have said body armor over the blazer, right? Like maybe you have the blazer in your bag and you put it on when you get to the meeting, right? But I've seen a whole bunch of bizarre combat DIY, you know, sort of fashion apparel. And I've never seen that particular.
Secretly hoping that Luke Hardig would update his men national security fashion to include combat wear for this purpose.
Luke, if you're listening, this is a special request for you. I'm quite interested to know how he conditions his hair because it was extraordinarily shiny and just very well kept.
Look, and that desert sun is going to be bad for his skin, which we've already talked about
it's
that skin care regime.
I just feel like if the man can have skin and hair like that, he probably can get Middle East peace.
That's true. Fair point.
You know,
I will say that the hashtag Kushner at war was pretty great. From here to fraternity, Band of Brooks Brothers, Saving Private Equity.
But just I want to say in his defense, as someone who went to Afghanistan, really not knowing what a person should wear when out and about. And one time had a picture taken where somebody was like, you look like a Bollywood actress who's just wandering around Afghanistan in body armor, which is like. Kind of
that's not the
right.
image that you were really looking
not what
for.
I was trying to project there. I just feel like I have a lot of empathy. And Jared, you know, if you want fashion tips, I'm totally open to giving
this
them.
Is a service that Bombshell is happy to provide to a great many professionals. It's not an unpaid service, we should note. This is a compensation situation. But we are here for you in a variety of different contexts. Should you need sartorial advice, whether you're wearing body armor or wearing suits?
That's right.
The most nervous I've ever been working in national security was packing my bag to go on like a 4-day trip to Afghanistan because I didn't think the trip was going to happen and I had like 10 minutes to pack. Like it was like more nervous than like the Iran negotiation, right. Cuba stuff. Like what do I wear when I go to Afghanistan?
I loved clothing decisions when I was deployed though.
But you probably had more than like 10 minutes to deal with it and you probably didn't have photographers following you around. Not me. But,
I
like,
had
my
no
boss.
Photographers. That's correct. But I... You know, I mean,
photographers always follow me.
There were no decisions. You wore your crappy khakis 5 days a week. You had 3 shirts. You rotated them. You had no makeup. You wore no jewelry. No one cared what your hair looked like. The Marines were happy that you smelled good. Like, that was it. You know, it was so much easier. You know, not that I want to wear 5'11s ever again, but like, it was so much easier than a daily existence here, you know, in office buildings in D.C., I have to say.
I mean, I feel like, just to close it out very quickly, I feel like men have a harder time on these calls than women. Women going out, you're like, you're sort of a novelty to begin with in terms of being in a combat zone.
Talking dog syndrome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas Jared Kushner, he probably was not going to win this fashion argument no matter what. He didn't really have any hope. Sorry, dude.
Sorry. Catch-22s are a real,
Real bitch.
Real bitch. Okay. So we have yet to name our final segment here. We're still debating amongst ourselves, but we enjoy our
We should maybe get our finalists and have a audience poll on this.
That's because you care what other people think about things?
Deeply.
Yeah, I don't.
You're a quant.
Not all quants care.
I'm a people-pleasing quant.
The ones that I wanted to talk to folks about, I think primarily based off the Devin Nunes skulking around the White House grounds, is spy novels and what makes for a good spy novel and what are in fact good spy novels. And I have a particular set of preferences, but also sort of a set of standards for spy novels. So spy novels are about plot, pacing, characters, and tradecraft. And different spy novels trade amongst all of those elements, right? So if you like Allen First, you don't care about pacing. Like, it's moody, it's Central Europe, it's lovingly written, it's boring as crap.
There's going to be a lot of ellipses throughout, so just like people trailing off in their sentences or in the context of what's happening.
You know, there's no reason, I mean, they're wonderful books, but even I find them too slow. And my, of course, favorite spy novel is Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, which many people find impossible to read, impenetrable, but is kind of the king of the tradecraft and the character spy novels. There are some, you know, other good elements, you know, here. The Company is quite good, which is kind of a historical or fictionalized history of the CIA. That's by Robert Littell. I'm also partial to the Charles McCary books, the Paul Christopher novels, which can be hit and miss, but the good ones are very good, and you sort of find your way.
So
you know,
I really enjoy spy novels when they have female protagonists in them.
Yeah, that's basically never.
Yeah, so I sort of like go on loose quests for various things. Also, on a side note, I just call them spy novels, not women's spy novels, and I'm going to continue to do that here.
You should.
But so I got on this kick from reading this, and many of them are historically set because I like historical fiction in general, and so these like historical spy novels are, fit in that general category. Codename Verity, which I highly recommend.
Oh, and that was going to be mine.
Oh, man. Yeah, okay. Well, I'll leave it for that. But I just finished this one, which I then realized was actually true and not really a real... I mean, it's written like a novel, but it turns out it's like a true story called Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, which is about four women who are various kinds of spies, and I won't give anything away because the development in it is great, during the Civil War. And it's actually about like actual women who were spies during the Civil War on different sides and kind of what their roles were and what they did and why they were so useful in those roles over time, but also kind of with the backdrop of Civil War history happening in real time. It's great.
Interesting.
I totally loved Codename Verity because on top of the elements that Radha has mentioned, I also love young adult fiction. Codename Verity, definitely a YA book, got all that emotional hit to it. But beyond having a woman as a member of the Special Operations Executive in Britain, also has a long discussion about women's role in the Air Transit Authority or Air Transit Auxiliary in Britain and their role in ferrying planes around the UK as well as over to Europe in the end of World War II. Amazing story. You might cry 39 times in it. I apologize, but really awesome book.
But totally worth it.
Oh, I'm going to have to add that to my list. I have not. I do not require my spy novels to have
particularly compelling female characters. They don't require them to. I just enjoy the female characters.
I like moody, broken, awful male characters, which...
I can't imagine why that would be, Aaron.
Yeah, let's not talk about that any further. Yeah. That's not going to be useful for anybody. On this front, Archer started again last week. And so we
it
might...
Is. It's film noir, right? This season?
Well, yes. Ish. It's Dreamland, right?
Noir.
Exactly. It's set, I think, in the 1920s or 30s. So what I think we'll do is set up a thread in the Warhol, which is a subscription-only service to our friends from our friends here at War on the Rocks. And we can talk about our favorite spy novels, but also talk about the premiere of the new season of Archer, which is particularly fun for those of us in the national security community. So for this episode of Bombshell, thanks for listening.